Welcome to Fatherhood for the Rest of Us with Brandon Handley. Because you're already great at everything else, why not fatherhood too?
Hey there, and welcome to Fatherhood for the Rest of Us. This is Brandon Handley. I am the creator and founder of Fatherhood for the Rest of Us. I want to say thank you for choosing to spend your time with me today on Fatherhood for the Rest of Us. I also want to just encourage you, if you could, to go over to the podcast on iTunes, download it, subscribe to it, and leave a review if you have found any part of this at all to have an impact on your life. That will help others to find the show and listen to it and get the same type of enjoyment that you are out of it. Also, if you are a father, and if you're looking for a place that you can go celebrate fatherhood, or perhaps even share some struggles and get some advice or find some like-minded men, I strongly encourage you to come on over to Fatherhood for the Rest of Us, the private Facebook group, and ask to join. I'll let you right in. That's going to do it for right now, guys. And please stay tuned for today's podcast.
All right. We are live with Rob Rosenthal. He is short order dad. Rob has had a love affair with food since he was, as he says, breastfed. He has some really great stories as it pertains to growing up and eating. And I was watching one of your videos, Rob, talking about your mom making the tuna fish sandwiches and just kind of how those were. And what I thought was kind of funny and cool was we both have kind of like this similar backstory where, like, if it wasn't us that was going to make some food to eat, we'd probably still be eating some crappy food.
Yeah, definitely. That was the case. Yeah, I mean, my mother's great, you know, still, and was a working woman early before, you know, that became a thing. Wasn't particularly talented in the kitchen, Brandon, and, you know, we used to say nobody baked the better potato. And my father, you know, also, you know, working less than incompetent in the kitchen. I mean, the guy had no clue. I'd only seen him really cook once. But when I say cook, I mean the guy made toast and he would open up a can of sardines. You know what I mean? So, like, his big thing was that he could put sardines on the toast, except that before he did that, he screwed up the toast because he would take ice cold butter and try to spread it, and he would essentially destroy the toast before the sardines even went on. So even that he screwed up. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't come from... It skipped a generation. You know, my grandmother could cook. But yeah, if I didn't figure out how to do it on my own, I wasn't eating the best stuff at that point.
Understood. Absolutely. So real quick, before we get going, what is something we can help you celebrate today, Rob? Yeah.
Another day of living.
Another day of living.
I don't know. Is today some kind of like special? Is there an answer that you had in mind?
You got something good that happened for you today? Something, anything to celebrate? Something good coming up outside of this amazing interview?
Well, sure. I could think of a half a dozen things. You ready? It starts with the fact that I woke up in the morning this morning. It's a good way to begin. I did some transcendental meditation today. This is very exciting for me. Did not have a chance to work out, which, you know, I would have rather have done. But the exciting news is that I got a kid coming back from college tomorrow.
Oh, awesome. So that's great. Very cool. Where he or she, where are they at?
Kid there is in, my daughter is in Madison, Wisconsin.
Madison, Wisconsin.
University of Wisconsin, Madison. Yeah, having a blast.
Very cool. It's just about done. Is this like the finish up coming home, or is this just a visit?
This is just a freshman spring break.
Got it. Very cool. Awesome. That's something to celebrate. The transcendental meditation. I have never done it. How long have you been doing that?
On and off for, you know, 2 or 3 years. Can you see how calm I am?
Yeah. I mean, you're like a still spring, flat pond of water type of deal.
Yeah, no, a couple 3 years. It's I'm not here to, you know, promote that as a particular practice, but I have to say that I find it super great, and I mean, I'm sure all meditation is probably has some value, but transcendental strikes me as being like for me, kind of, you know, a cut above. I just really like it. I like the I like the feeling of it. I like what I feel perceived to be the benefits of it. It's good.
I love it. I love it. Very cool. So let's hop into it, right? Like, we talked a little bit about how you got into food. What we didn't say is that, you know, you've got a culinary degree. When did you get your culinary degree, and what made you decide to, like, become so passionate about food?
Well, hey, look, again, you know, the passion started early, Brandon. I joke that, you know, some guys, like, have a vivid memory of their first sexual experience, and me, I'll never forget my first piece of pizza. So I, you know, I've said that before, but, like, I was always into, you know, food and cooking, and growing up, I even watched some of what was the very early kind of, food television shows, cooking shows, which was great because I figured out how to replicate some of those meals on my own. And then what happened is I got kind of lucky in a way from an eating perspective because, you know, to be honest, my parents divorced. I must have been like 12 or 13. And then my father moved into New York City. And since he couldn't cook and he had an apartment with like a kitchen here in the New York City apartment is the size of a closet in which he kept his bicycle. So he literally handed me a book. When we would be here every weekend, my brother and I, in the city, he literally handed me a book, my father, and he said, here, pick a, it was New York Times Review of Restaurants, mm-hmm. right? And he hands me a book, he goes, all right, pick a place. So I was eating at decent places from the time that I was a kid. College was kind of a culinary wasteland, but when I left college, I got into advertising. And okay. The thing about the advertising was that I was in a position working on big accounts where we were entertained by sales reps in the media, like regularly. I mean, I literally was eating out like three or four times a week, lunch at fabulous places. And I mean, even though I was like running, jogging every day, like 4 or 5 miles, at the end of that year, from eating out all those restaurants, I had gained 20 pounds. So at some point, my job in advertising became more international. And the best part of it was that I got to eat really around the world, like mm-hmm. on 6 continents. But at night here in the city, I did stand up, you know. And then I got a professional culinary degree at night. So I was working during the day, and I got the degree at night. And that's kind of how it all evolved. I wanted to be able to have the training.
Okay. And that evolved into where you became one of the primary cook at home, right?
Even before, yes. The short answer is yes, yeah, sure. What happens is my wife also is a working woman. So we're both working. And in the distribution of labor, I was like, I'll do the cooking because, you know, I know how to do it and I like doing it.
Right.
So that's what happened. And I have, you know, I have two daughters. So I was doing really all the cooking, virtually all the cooking. And, at some point, and I was like, I'd make breakfast, you know what I mean, before going to work, before the kids went to school. And my daughters are great, but, you know, when it came to breakfast, they were kind of a pain in the butt because they never agreed on the same thing. And I found myself making eggs 2 ways and toast 2 ways and 2 different kinds of milk and different cereal. And I looked at them like, after years, I go, what do I look like, a short order cook? Right. And they actually said, yeah, you're short order day. So at some point, my wife is like, okay, you should really kind of write a book. And I listened. When I say I listened, I mean 10 years later, I wrote the book.
Sure.
And the book is Short Order Dead. And it's based on my experience of cooking for the family. So it's my way of kind of promoting, if you will, the idea of getting more men to cook more meals more often, because I found it not only kind of, you know, I enjoy doing it, but more importantly, it from on a serious level, it has profound impact on the family when you actually spend some time, you know, cooking and eating together. It makes a difference.
Yeah, you've got a great article. Actually, I wanted to hit on that for you. Was the great article that you wrote for Good Man, Good Dad Project, one of those two.
Good Man's Project, I wrote that piece.
Yeah, right. You wrote a great article talking about the importance of eating together as a family, and you cited a lot of really, do you remember some of that stuff off the top of your head?
I do, actually. Here's the bottom line, is we lived at a point in time in culture when people seem to be more obsessed with food than ever before, right? I mean, right. It's not only that you're getting it at 24/7 on television networks, and you can hit, you know, recipes up the wazoo on a website, and on my Instagram feed is nothing but other people taking photos of their food, and then you have people writing reviews on Yelp and TripAdvisor and everything. So people apparently are obsessed with food, except for one thing, cooking it. Because last year was the first time in history, Brandon, that more money was spent on going out to eat and drink than on groceries in this country.
I'm shocked.
And it's really simply a sociocultural phenomenon based on the fact that you have, well, 70% of moms at this point are in the workforce, right? And historically, you know, like in back in the day, they were primarily responsible for meal preparation. So even though you have more guys kind of cooking now, they haven't made up for the fewer women who are doing it. And so we're eating less meals at home. And here's what the problem is. The problem with that is not that we all don't love going to restaurants, right? The problem with that is that if you look at research over the last 15, 20, 25 years, it's been consistent. The findings have been consistent, independent research, that kids that eat together with the family at home do better. They do better academically. They do better nutritionally. They do better emotionally. So it's, you don't even have to take my word for it, but what I cited in the article, all the statistics indicating that time that you spend together at the table, sharing that family time together, is almost more valuable, or in some ways more valuable than even reading to kids. Test scores were higher. Emotional stability was greater. Nutritionally, I mean, less obesity, less smoking. There's 1,000 benefits to it. So I felt like, you know, I could do what little bit I could do to try to promote the idea of guys kind of cooking more, because the benefits are there. And so that's why I wrote the book, and there you go.
No, a great article. I mean, you've written quite, you contribute to, you know, Huffington Post, Food and Wine. Your repertoire is great and amazing. So we could go all over that place, but I want to stick with like, food and whatnot, but I definitely, you know, for people that are paying attention to the podcast, tuning into the Facebook Live, go check Rob out, shoulderdad.com, and, you know, just Google him, check out, he's got some YouTubes. I'll share the links when we're all done, but just a lot of really good material out there, Rob. And I'll have to tell you the one thing I was telling my wife about before I came up here. We actually just got done sitting at the dinner table eating dinner and came up here, and I had to laugh. You were interviewing Carla from the television network or Food Network, you were talking about like Halloween candy, what you hand out, and she said she hands out a pencil, and your response was immediate, and it was what?
I can't think of anything worse than that.
Oh, that was great.
Exactly what I said. I don't think that she was pleased because Carla is a great, she's great. She is exactly in person what you see on camera. You know, she's delightful and charming and a bullion. But yeah, we're talking about Halloween because that was the week of that particular video, which I, you know, go out on the street and sometimes she's there. I mean, people are there. And she said, yeah, you know what I give out for Halloween? I give out pencils. And I go, I can't think of anything worse than that. Especially from a woman, by the way, who is a career professional baker, for God's sake.
But I'll tell you what, too. I think it's interesting to hear that because I don't think she knows any other way to be than just how she is. Right? She looks, she's on, right?
You know, it's interesting. That's, I think what you find generally in TV land, not among actors and actresses, they have a job to be somebody else. Mm-hmm. Among the people that are coming to you representing who they are, right? We can detect who's phony and who isn't. We can detect realness. And so, yeah, so she's real. The reason that she didn't win Top Chef, right? That's where people came to know her. Mm-hmm. But the reason that she's on television is because she connected with the audience because she's super likable. And I mean that on camera, but I mean first and foremost in real life.
Right. Gotcha. You mentioned like some early TV shows, what like Julia Child, and I just want to throw this out there. You know, one of my first TV, like The Frugal Gourmet on like PBS or something like that. It was like, I mean, anytime I think of some of the first television shows, did you ever get the opportunity to watch that growing up?
Yeah, I'll tell you why I'm laughing, by the way, with speaking about people that are real and not real. I mean, here's the thing. I grew up, I did stuff that all the boys do, you know what I mean? I was in Little League, I played sports after school, and I watched baseball on TV, but I also watched cooking shows. So like, I mean, Julia was maybe even before my time. She was really early, but there was a guy back in the day, the Galloping Gourmet. He was a guy that I would watch. Very funny. A dude that was cooking fancy French food. And while he was doing it, he would like down a bottle of wine. So by the end of the show, he was trashed, but that was great TV. I watched, over the years, a guy by the name of Jacques Pepin, who's kind of the master. He's been doing it for 30 years. And I had the chance to meet him and interview him more than one time. The guy, the Frugal Gourmet, showed up on PBS, and he. I'm not saying that he always appeared a little bit sketchy, but at the end of the day, they found out he was a child abuser.
Oh no, that's tragic. Oh man,
yeah, I mean, so, he was not one of my favorites. I mean, I would see if I watched everything, mm-hmm. But yeah, the Frugal Gourmet ended up getting tossed back early for sexual things with like teenage boys.
That's a shame, man. There goes all my good memories. Thanks, man.
I'm sorry. I didn't
you just ruined a good thing, Rob. No harm, no foul. Let's talk about,
it's very, more, it's, you know, you have now, you have like a whole, you know, you got a lot of guys, and I'm thinking about like, you know, Mario Batali and these guys who are out for different reasons. But also, you know, due to unsavory and reprehensible behavior oftentimes. But it's so it happens.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a shame. It's a shame that
It's a shame that I screwed up your
memories. Yeah, I just flushed out a bunch of good memories. They're out. one of your episodes. So you're also doing the – so, again, you've got the Shorter Dads. You got the website. You've got the Instagram feed. You've got tons of, articles out there for people to read. You've got like a show as well, like a what's the name of your like video series?
Well, you know what, the video is I do videos for a kind of a big food website, like a mega food website. It's called The Daily Meal. And it changes all the time. I've been out on the street. Mm-hmm. Where you saw the call, a whole piece. Last week, I was at an event, a charity event called Chefs for the Kids Cancer. They raised money for pediatric cancer research. I interviewed some of your Food Network celebrities, and that's on, you know, now it's on like the Daily Meal. So, and I've gone and, you know, done kitchen work in there where I cook with the celebrities or whatever. So, that shows up on the Daily Meal, and the podcast. Who knows? I just started that about 5 weeks ago. You might have inspired me, and as I was saying, that's interesting because I like doing it. It runs live on Wednesday nights at 8:00. I love working live.
Yeah, that's also interesting too, because most of them. I mean, you and I are going live right now, but yours is live and broadcast live to a radio station, right?
That's correct. It runs live online. It gets pumped into a radio station. And then I think at the end, because, you know, Wednesday night at 8:00, I can't, you know, even though it's globally available, who knows how many people at this point are tuning in for it. But the good news, of course, is that they're putting it up on YouTube, on SoundCloud, on Spreaker. And I think in another couple of weeks, it shows up on iHeartRadio. So it's all, but I like doing it.
Yeah, no, it's fun, and I think you do a good job. I've been enjoying it. I listened to a couple of the episodes, but I have to rib you just a little bit. I was checking out the titles of the podcast. And like the first one was like a really long title. The second one was like a little bit shorter, and I think the last one was like just Rob Rosen. Is the next one just going to be Rob? The Latin,
yeah, R,
just R. Rob.
I changed the name of the podcast. That I did. I had the first couple of weeks, it was Rob Rosenthal's Hot Lunch program. And then somebody said to me, why Hot Lunch? And even though there's a story behind Hot Lunch, it didn't make as much sense. I thought I came up with a better podcast. Now it's All You Can Eat.
Right.
Right. So that is the name. And anything that you're seeing that deviates from that is a graphics issue versus a name.
One of the episodes that you did, you hit a lot on spices. What is a spice? What is like the best known spice? What is your favorite spice that we don't know about? Like, what is something that we should be having with our meals that we're not?
Well, I'm going to give you two or three, but it turns out that they are, they're blends. It's interesting to me. People complain oftentimes, Brandon, about like, I don't know what to cook, and or if I cook, I'm bored because I make the same thing all the time. And the easiest way to change the flavor profile is to use a spice, but in particular, a spice blend. So specifically, for example, there's a spice called berberine, B-E-R-B-E-R-E, right? And I got turned on to it by another one of those celebrity guys, Marcus Samuelson. And then I said to him, when you cook, like, give me something with the fewest ingredients, you know, to make. And he's like, well, I take some berberine and I put it on. I go, what? Well, berberine, he's an Ethiopian guy, so it's an Ethiopian spice. Literally, there's probably 10 to 12 spices in berberine.
Okay.
Right? Everything from cinnamon and cardamom and cloves to fenugreek and red pepper and blah, 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 right? So what I'm saying is that if you were cooking a piece of fish or a piece of chicken or a vegetable, right, and you wanted to really max out the flavor on it, all you'd have to do is hit it up with a hit of berberine. You've literally added 10 flavors to that one piece of fish. So I love the spice blends for that reason. So that's one. Another one, basic one, is just Herbes de Provence, right, which you get in any supermarket. What's the beauty of Herbes de Provence? Same deal. Provence is in the south of France, notable for its great flavors, tomatoes, olives, basil, marjoram, sage, rosemary. And so Herbes de Provence is literally a blend of 6, 8, 10 different herbs and spices. And what do I use Herbes de Provence on? It's great on chicken. It's great with eggs. It's perfectly good thrown into a vinaigrette. Mm. So again, the spice blend. And let's go one more blend. Now, that's too complicated. I'll tell you, here's another thing. Two separate ones. I love ancho chili powder.
Okay.
It has a slight, it's even though it has the word chili in it, it's not the hottest chili pepper, but it's a lovely southwestern kind of flavor profile. Almost a little bit, it's like raisiny. It's beautiful. I love ancho. I would toss that when shrimp go on sale. I'll buy a pound of shrimp, right? Hit them up with some salt, give them a hit of ancho chili powder, and saute it for 3 or 4 minutes in some olive oil, and you have beautiful ancho chili shrimp, just delicious. And another one that I use all the time is called smoked paprika, or known as pimenton. And the beauty of smoked paprika is that if you like the flavor of smoke, you don't have to smoke up your house. You don't have to add liquid smoke. Hit up chickpeas, for example, with some smoked paprika, and throw the chickpeas in a toaster oven for 5-10 minutes until they get like yummy. And it's just beautiful flavor if you like the flavor of smokiness. If good in eggs, good with anything. So those are four right there. Oh, and one more, because you asked. If you get Frank's hot sauce out on the, where are you, on the West Coast? Where exactly are you?
I'm in North Carolina.
Oh, I had that only wrong by like.
I was born in California, so you had a good chance.
Okay. Well, Frank's hot sauce is famous in Buffalo, New York, because that's how they make buffalo chicken wings. But the beauty of Frank's is that it's loaded up with vinegar, red pepper, and salt, right? So I'll just take chicken wings, hit them up with, douse them up with Frank's hot sauce, throw them into the oven until they get like, you look at them and you go, oh, those are ready now. Crispy, salty, spicy, beautiful Frank's hot sauce liquid.
You're baking them with the Frank's hot sauce on them?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Check. Get your wings or your thighs, right? Mm-hmm. You hit them up with Frank's. They get a nice color red. I put them into the oven. I put it on super high heat, right? And then when a fire alarm goes off, right, the smoke alarm, I just turn the oven like way down and let them sit in there until they get that kind of brown, beautiful kind of like golden crustiness. And then you go, yeah, those must be ready because they're like crispy and they're brown. And on the inside, they're still good. It's kind of hard to destroy a chicken wing. Mm. And then and just like that. So two ingredients is kind of like my my goal. How about you eat you got clams down where you got good clams down where you live, right?
Yeah, man. Yeah.
I take clams, smaller ones, like little neck versus the, you know, the bigger ones, and you rinse them. And then when you're doing grilling this summer, right, you lay them down nicely on a hot grill.
Right.
And you put the lid on the grill.
Yeah.
Right. And you check back every once in a while. And then at some point, those clams open up.
Right.
Right. And then you eat them. And then every time I make that dish, you know what happens? People go, Rod, you've got to give me the recipe.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That's one ingredient. Like, you don't need to add, because that stuff cooks in its own little broth there. And it's just like beautiful eating. So, you know, that's kind of the idea.
It doesn't have to be complicated.
Not only does it not have to be complicated, I'm kind of anti-complicated. I mean, I was doing the podcast last night, and I happened to have done just all recipes, which is one of those kind of nights.
Right.
And my goal is like most taste, fewest ingredients, least effort, right? Mm-hmm. So most everything I had is like that, like five ingredients, whatever is maxed out or six. There was one recipe, though, for, you know, Andrew Zimmern on television. He travels around or whatever. I just love chicken wings. So he has one for, like, spicy Chinese chicken wings. And it just looks so good that I did the recipe. But to be honest with you, it's got, like, 12 ingredients. That's, like, seven more than I really want to use. So I'm like, I gave the recipe. But at the same time, you go to the supermarket, right? I'm not big on buying, like, you know, the teriyaki marinade. But if you have your own soy sauce and some garlic and some ginger, you know, marinate it like that. Throw it in the oven. You don't have to fry. Like easy, good, big taste. Anybody can do it.
What was like your daughter's favorite dinner meal for like that you made?
I'm glad that you asked. A couple of things. I mean. It's interesting. The cooking school I go to is based on French technique, right? But I'm not cooking French food. You know what I mean? So the answer is that they're happy if I like kind of pound out a chicken breast and give it a quick grill on both sides, put a nice cold salad on top of it, maybe, you know, shred a little bit of Parmesan cheese. And like all kids, they like pasta. Mm. So here's another three ingredient, like master dish. There's an Italian pasta called cacio e pepe. Cacio e pepe is kind of like the pasta of Rome, because cacio is what they call, it's like the nickname for pecorino romano. So pecorino cheese, pecorino romano, like Roman pecorino, is a salty sheep's milk cheese. So it's got a lot of flavor and it's got plenty of its own salt content in it. And pepe is pepper. So you with me?
I'm with you.
Well, three ingredients. And I didn't think that they would go for it because one of those ingredients is black pepper. But I don't mean like a little bit. I mean like a shitload. I mean like a lot of black pepper, pecorino cheese, and the pasta. And the only thing that binds it all together,
right,
is the starchy water that you cooked the pasta in. Well, I make this, and I'm thinking they're not going to like it because it's kind of peppery. Well, to this day, in answer to your question, what's the favorite, the dish for my girls? They'll have cacio e pepe and be like super happy.
That's cool. That's cool, and it's simple. I love it. Well, I don't think that everybody. Tell me, pasta water. Rinsing the pasta after you make a spaghetti or something like that, is that like the worst thing you could do? Or, you know, tell us, because, you know, let's talk about that for a second, because I don't think that that's a well-known fact.
Anything you want to know, you're in the right place right now about these exact kind of questions. Yes, rinsing the pasta after you cook it is literally the worst thing that you can do.
Why?
You want to get into the technical piece of it? It's related to the starch and the texture. Generally, pasta has to be sauced, right?
Right.
You want the inherent starchiness that comes with the pasta. That's what glues any sauce to the pasta. You not only don't you want to rinse it, you, like I said, on the CotriFF, you want to save some of that starchy pasta water always. And more importantly, or as importantly, you always want to cook pasta to the al dente stage, al dente to the bite. It has a little bit of chew to it. If you cook pasta too much, it gets limp. And you really don't want limp pasta. You cook maybe a minute or so less than the instructions on the box. Mm-hmm. And then you finish the pasta with the sauce. And the only other point I would make to you, Brandon, is that, believe it or not, different pastas call for different sauces.
Mm, okay.
So I actually wrote about it just coincidentally in the book. For example, this is why you always see, like, if I say fettuccine, you say Alfredo, right?
Sure.
There's a reason why they serve fettuccine, which is like a flat pasta, in a cream sauce. Like, those things go together. If I say penne, right, we go like arrabbiata, which is a spicy kind of, you know, tomato sauce. So different pastas go with different sauces. At the end of the day, does it matter if you serve like a ziti, which is that tubular pasta, is really good with like a meat sauce. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, does it matter if you have the wrong pasta with the wrong sauce? No. But pasta is intended to kind of marry with different sauces because it adheres better to the pasta. And part of that is don't drain or rinse the pasta when you're done cooking it.
Guys, that is important. That is important. If you take nothing away from this, aside from his book, that's an important tip. You're gonna.
I have a lot of tips.
How about the bow tie pasta? What the hell am I supposed to serve with the bow tie pasta? What's the sauce for that?
Farfalle. Farfalle, bow tie pasta, actually goes well now with spring vegetables, by which I mean this. You ready? Here's what I would do if I had farfalle in the house. It's all about the shopping. If you pick up, for example, some spring vegetables, it's going to be some peas. Maybe it's going to be some, I like those, like a snow peas are good. Little broccoli, little broccoli cut into little florets. Maybe some cherry tomatoes. That stuff all feels nice to me, whether the sauce is made with like a kind of a chickeny broth or a vegetable broth or even a tomato thing. Farfalle works out nicely with like little bits of spring vegetables.
Man, I just ate dinner and I'm hungry, man. I'm hungry. I am.
You like that.
I love, man. I love some food. I love me some food. And I enjoy definitely being able to talk. When you get the opportunity to talk to somebody who's beyond into food, it's a pleasure. And when you actually get to learn something too, that's a bonus. The other thing that you talked about in your show, which I enjoyed hearing too, was foods that are in season. You know, when you go and you buy a tomato in a grocery store, that's just like rinsing off your pasta for the most part. You want to talk a little bit about, you know, just why you buy your foods in season? What's the difference? Why can't I just buy a red tomato?
Yeah, all the difference in the world. I'm glad that you brought it up because I have a simple philosophy in the book, but more than the book. I have a simple philosophy in my cooking. Get the best ingredients you can. Are kids watching this? No. I mean, can I use some...
Do it up.
I have a philosophy in cooking, and it says get the best ingredients you can, don't fuck them up too much. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So it starts with the shop, and the answer to the question is that if you've ever had a tomato, I can't speak to North Carolina. I would say on the East Coast, for example, New York and New Jersey get surprisingly fabulous farm-grown tomatoes in August, in late July, August, maybe September. You have that window. Those tomatoes are so good and so juicy and so vibrant and so filled with flavor that if all you do is, you know, hit them up with a little salt and bite into them, it's heaven, right? Tomato turns out to be a fruit, by the way, rather than a vegetable. But the difference is that the rest of the year, that tomato blows. It's tasteless. I mean, like, you know, I will literally go to a restaurant, and I don't mean like necessarily a good one because they know better. But sometimes you see stuff the sandwich has a tomato on it. And I literally go, tell me, the tomato is like I don't want this myth. So it's the same with anything. In answer to your question, you eat in season because that's when you're going to get the absolute optimal taste, flavor, everything that brings you know, a fruit and vegetable together. And it's tough because you don't always know, do you, right? You go to the supermarket, you see a box of strawberries, you go, must be good. But I'm going to tell you something. You taste a strawberry off the vine, you know, which you get from some local farm when it's picked. And that's not the same taste you're going to get from the box that comes in that's been sprayed with some ethylene, whatever. It's the same thing with anything in the world, Brandon. If I go out in North Carolina and I go fishing, right, I could open up and gut that fish right on a boat and eat it raw, and it'll be the best sushi you've ever had. But, you know, a week later, flown in from somewhere else, flesh, you know, whatever, frozen, everything in food, which is ingredient dependent, is built on kind of like getting it at its max. And you get it at its max when it is both fresh in season and for the most part local. And I say for the most part local because they're pulling out fish right now in Japan, but they're like freezing it instantly and sending it over here. It's not that you can't get good ingredients from other parts of the world. I'm not saying that. It doesn't all have to be local, but you have a better chance of getting fresh, real fresh, when it comes to, especially to fruits, vegetables, you know, fish, chicken, eggs, if you're getting it from a local source, obviously. Yeah. But freshness matters.
I mean, the taste is worlds apart. It really is.
Yeah.
My wife was never a tomato fan until I brought her some local like heirlooms, and her mind was blown, and she was in her 30s.
Oh, trust me, it happens to us all the time. You could be any age and still go, oh, wait a second, I had no idea. It happens all the time.
That happened to me with balsamic vinegar. You know, the stuff that you get from the store, like the Modena bottle. Versus,
right.
We have a place down here called Van Foss, pouring it out of a oak cask. I was blown away.
Balsamic is an interesting one, right? Because that is the basic brand, the balsamic of Modena. It's like your basic supermarket brand. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's like the difference between there's levels of anything, right? You can get okay beer, you can get great beer, you can get amazing beer. It's so the gradations of almost any category of food in the world exist, including in vinegar. I got it as a present because I won't spend it myself, but there's aged balsamic vinegar. I'm talking 7 years, 14, whatever. It's $150 for a bottle this size. You don't use a lot of it. You put a drop of it on a strawberry, and that'll blow your mind. So it's the same with anything in the world. You know, I'm not suggesting we always invest in the high end stuff, but there are degrees. One of the tricks with balsamic, by the way, if you want to, is to buy the store bought stuff and put it in a saucepan, mm-hmm. right, and put on the heat,
okay,
and reduce it until it gets kind of like a glaze,
okay.
And that intensifies the flavor of it. You don't necessarily use it the same way, in other words, as a salad dressing. But when you're bored with like vegetables, you know, you could put a little balsamic glaze on them, right? I mean, like that's the beauty of this. If you have the right ingredients, you can make stuff taste really good. You know, people go, you know, vegetables, whatever. You could steam a vegetable, which is not the way to maximize the flavor. There's other ways to max flavor on a vegetable. But even if you steam a vegetable, if I pull out a vegetable, say steamed, let's say broccoli, right? Mm-hmm. And I want to give it a little extra hit of flavor, I can hit it up with a nice olive oil. Okay. I can hit it up with a nice bit of sea salt. You can give it a little squeeze of lemon, or even better than the lemon, just the lemon zest. Or I could reduce balsamic as an
example. With your microplaner, right, Rob? A little bit of that microplaner, lemon zest. Yeah. And a little bit of Costco olive oil is my guess. I don't know for sure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Fatherhood for the Rest of Us. I hope that you've enjoyed what you've heard so far as we have an engaging deep dive into what fatherhood means to us, what it means to have the fatherhood experience. And I'd also like to let you know that I currently have a couple of coaching slots available. If you are looking to make some impactful lifelong changes in your own life, creating a better life today instead of waiting, and you're ready to take on some new challenges, form a new set of beliefs, let go of some of your limiting beliefs, take care of the gap, get rid of what's missing, work on what's been working for you, then let's have that conversation. You reach out to me at brandon@fatherhoodfortherestofus.com. You can reach out to me at Brandon G. Hanley on Facebook. And if you just want to go schedule a time, you can do that over at fatherhoodfortherestofus.com/coaching. Looking forward to having that conversation with you.
Yeah, very good. I'm glad to see you paying attention. I like that. So even if you have, even with the balsamic, all I'm saying is you could reduce it down. You could even put a stick of rosemary or thyme in balsamic, hit it down, and then you have a glaze out of it. But yeah, you're right. We discover new flavors all the time.
I think another one you mentioned on your show, which I don't think a lot of people hit too often, is not thyme. Was it marjoram?
Tarragon.
I mean, fresh tarragon was a revelation for me that I grew in the garden and would serve one of the recipes that I'll share. One of my favorites was like, you take the fresh tarragon and you would bake an egg in a tomato and put that fresh tarragon in there. And amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. A brilliant herb for me, like maybe my favorite. And you've used it exactly the right way, because tarragon goes really well with egg. It goes really well with tomato. It goes really well with chicken. It goes well with fish. So, you know, I like to roast the chicken every week. And I literally, when I can find it, I'll take tarragon and just, you know, kind of stuff it under the skin and in the cavity. And it perfumes the whole thing. Now, I love tarragon, but I get that there are people that don't love that anise. Licorice kind of profile. It's from that family.
It's delicate though, right? It's kind of like a light for me, anyways, right? Just really, but it's definitely noticeable. And I had to laugh. I do enjoy your podcast. I'm enjoying what you're doing. And I have been on the edge of picking up an air fryer myself, and you probably sealed the deal. I'll probably end up grabbing one of those. Tell us. We'll hit cooking like one or two more cooking pieces and we'll move on. But hit us with the air fryer, because I'll bet you it took you a while to pull the trigger too.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. It's funny that you ask. All right, so here's what happens, right? I have a friend that's big on the tailgating. You know, he goes out to the stadium before the Giants game. When I say big, I've never seen a spread like these guys put out. I mean, they don't even go to the game for the game. This is about like professional high level tailgate eating. And he's making some exotic stuff. And I go, oh, that's great. And then, oh, he goes, I made it in my air fryer. This is years ago. And I go, air fryer, really? You got to get one. He says, I don't. But I said, well, just like, if I'm going to get one, I don't know why I would. Well, there's a reason why you would. You get an air fryer for no other reason than that you can have, theoretically, French fries that they're not soaked in, you know, oil, right? Well, long story short, some time goes by, and then I see that it's available. I hit the button on Amazon. I get the air fryer, and the first thing I do is I throw some of those frozen French fries in it. But that, and they're great. Like, they're super crispy, fantastic. But so would they be if you put them in the oven, you know? So then I started throwing, you know, chicken wings into it. And I'm like, well, just like some Franks or some Berberin, whatever.
You're a fan of the chicken wing, huh?
That chicken wing, chicken thigh, I started throwing those in there, and that was like, oh, this is really good. Like, you don't have to really do much. I mean, just like halfway through, you just kind of turn it over, and these are really good. And then I realized the air fryer that I had was big enough to hold. This is where it changed for me. That air fryer that I have is big enough to hold the entire chicken, right? Like, you could buy chicken cut up, you could buy it whole. You're roasting for four people, I'm happy having it whole, right? Mm-hmm. Which we could talk about having kitchen scissors or shears afterwards. But I take the whole chicken, I hit it up with some salt, throw a little lemon in the cavity, throw some garlic in the cavity. If I have, whether or not you have herb or not, it doesn't matter. Like, if you have salt, and you have pepper, to be honest with you, that's kind of all you need. But I like to, you know, gild it a little bit. I give it some, you know, lemon, whatever, garlic. I put that in the air fryer. I hit the temperature to 400. That's the max. I hit 60 minutes. And in 30 minutes, I flip the thing over. And now my wife is like, that's the best roast chicken you've ever made. I don't even use the oven anymore. Like, this is where it turned for me. Like, I can roast an entire chicken in the freaking air fryer. Uh-huh. And it's super crispy skin, because that's what you're paying for. Like, right. That, it's air circulating. So every bit of that skin is crispy, and the interior, the meat, the chicken on the inside stays moist and juicy. It's brilliant. Love that thing. And by the way, I stuck up the link to it on my website.
You do.
And you're not the only one. Seriously, after I did the podcast, my people were like calling me, going like, "Tell me about that air fryer again." And it's weird because I turned on the TV the other day, and there's an infomercial. Are you with me? It's like a guy. Is infomercialing the air fryer. If I had known that, I would never have bought the thing, because I just operate assuming that the infomercial is full of shit.
Sure.
But it's not. But in this case, because I actually used it, it turns out that that's the real deal. I just love the thing.
Right. And you'd even mentioned the one that you were looking at was like 119. It's actually down to 115. And the one that was being hawked is, you know, got some extra bells and whistles on it. Would you have been excited or grateful to have that earlier, like when your kids were growing up? Would that have been a nice thing to have?
Sure.
Yeah. Sounds like
that. Sure.
I'm not trying to sell myself any more than I have to. Because I'll probably.
I wouldn't, here's the thing. I'm in a business where I spent 25 years professionally promoting, you know, products. And that's different. I was paid, you know, to do that. And yet I still only really worked on things that I, you know, believed in. But now more than ever, I'll never recommend something that I myself don't believe in. I just don't have the patience or the time for that.
Sure enough. Yeah. No, that's awesome. That's great. I love that. Which was what made you talking about it, you know, that much greater. Because, you know, I could tell. Well, at least I felt like I could tell. All right, brother. We've covered pretty much the stuff that I know I wanted to as it related to kind of food and the cooking, and I enjoyed that immensely. Let's just talk a little bit about fatherhood. You and I actually, we met at Dad 2.0. I caught the end of your session. I enjoyed it. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the comedy. Not enough time today on that, but I loved your just kind of, you got this like really cool background. What, you know, brings you into the Dad 2.0, and we'll just jump right into, you know, the standard questions I ask here in the end. It's like, what does fatherhood mean to you?
It's kind of easy for me. I mean, I've been lucky in a lot of ways, but if I look back on kind of all the things that, all the jobs that I've had, and there's been a bunch of them. I mean, there's no job that will ever compare. And I use job kind of loosely. But there's no job that'll ever compare to the job that you have as a father. And of everything that I've ever done in my life, I think the thing that I'm most kind of like, you know, proud of, I think, you know, part of the, that I think is my greatest accomplishment is really having to do with, you know, with being a father. It's a, you know, I don't know. It's people who are fathers already understand. It may be people, maybe it's hard to describe to those who aren't, you know what I mean? I mean, there are people, but the point of the story is that, you know, it's nothing really that compares to kind of the joy, that you get out of seeing, you know, your kids, happy and healthy and productive. I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's been the greatest job in my life and always will be. I've done nothing that I've done better than being a father. And it's not like I'm patting myself. It's that I feel great pride and joy, you know, with my kids.
That's great. That's great. The you talked a little bit about your dad. Sounds like your parents, you know, got, you know, separated at a certain point. sounds like he was still active in your life, you know, kind of growing up. What was your relationship like with him?
Oh, it's great. I mean, I guess I, in that way, was lucky too, because the deal was that even though, you know, they separated, we would spend every weekend, you know, with him. So if you look at both kind of like the quantity of time and the quality of time, I'm pretty sure it surpassed whatever it was prior to that. Because now now you've got concentrated time together. And he was, he was great. And he was, you know, our relationship, my brother and I was, always positive, always favorable. I don't know how he knew what to do in the same way that maybe none of us really know. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like what do you know about doing anything that you've never done before? But, you know, then you look back on, you know what I mean? Like, then you look back on it in retrospect and I think, you know, he just did some stuff that, you know, that felt like it was good. He was imperfect, right? None of us are really perfect. We all do things that we, you know, wish we hadn't. We make mistakes. My thinking about fatherhood, Brandon, goes like this. My job as a father is to impart whatever I can on my kids such that they make more good decisions, you know, than bad ones. Do you know what I mean?
It's absolutely. Like
you instill values, you teach what it is that you know, you take the best care of them that you can, and then you keep your fingers crossed that when it comes time for them to be independent and to make decisions, that they're making a whole lot more right ones than not right.
Sure. At least not as many mistakes as we made ourselves.
Well, that's true.
we try to avoid that for them. When you were talking about your dad, it sounded like there were a couple of things that really stuck out for you when you think about him that you either, you know, carried forth with yourself or that you kind of cherished. What were some of the things that like really stuck out and shined for him?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He they were different, my parents, in that my father was very much black and white, right or wrong. Good or not good. There wasn't a lot of middle ground, you know what I mean? But he was a man of great integrity. My mother was really way more about the middle, the gray, you know? So I got lucky because I kind of, you know, I picked up from both sides. So the point of telling you that is that what you get from him was the kind of importance of integrity. You get out, he would always say, you know, you get out of something what you put into it, you know what I mean? He was a lawyer, Brandon, but he used to call himself an hourly worker in the sense that, you know, his work, you know, you get paid by the hour. So he was a straight shooting, a guy. And so you pick up, you know, the importance of doing the right thing. Hmm. And my mother also, I'm lucky again, because she was also, you know, into like the brutal truth. We're not really good at editing ourselves. We kind of say in my gang what it is that we think, you know, and what it is that we feel. But I would say also in terms of other things about him, my father, I mean, like he took us, you know, like he found things to do. Like he didn't know what to do as a single guy in the city other than date as many women as he could, which was fun in its own way. But I mean, it'd be like, you know, we would go to, you know, go ride bikes or, you know, go out to these different restaurants or, you know, experiences. So he, I don't know if there's a precise lesson that I got. It was more the lesson of being kind of like upstanding of effort, and of doing the right thing. And those are meaningful lessons.
Yeah, that's absolutely. Absolutely meaningful. Love it. When we opened this thing up, you talked a little bit about transcendental meditation, and I'm always curious about kind of, you know, whether or not you had faith, you know, religion in your background, or, you know, kind of a worldview, and how that played out in your family.
Well, I mean, quite simply, I'm proud of where I come from culturally. You know what I mean? I'm proud of what I would call my religion, but I'm not a religious guy. I'm not a big believing guy. You know what I mean? So it's that kind of dichotomy, is that I feel a cultural connection to my people, but I'm not the kind of guy that's heavily into religion or into that kind of belief system.
Okay.
You know, the TM has nothing to do with anything other than I find that the more things that you do, the more experiences that you have in your life, whatever they are, you know, if you pick up one little thing from everything that you do, there's a lot of stuff to pick up over time, you know, and I'm ancient at this point. So anyway, I don't know. Oh, I know what brought me to the TM was simply that I saw some other people that I so admired, and like Jerry Seinfeld, 35 years doing transcendental meditation. It's like, wow, that's, you know, like I wouldn't have pictured it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I guess I had the opportunity at some point to check it out, and I liked it enough to do it, and I still like it. I think that there's value in it.
That's interesting.
Is that
I think that you know, hits on it, hits what I'm looking at for. It's funny that you bring up the TM. There was literally I'm looking at going to a session down the street in a couple of weeks. So just check it out. So it's just, I'll have to let you know how that goes.
Do that.
I will. You wrote a book. Are you a big book reader yourself? Are you? Do you read a lot of you know, self-help books or fiction, history? Do you have a favorite one or two?
I barely ever read fiction. I'm way more of a nonfiction type of guy. And to be honest about it, I read a lot, but I consume a lot more from what I'm reading, honestly, kind of in the online world,
okay,
than I am from books. It's not that I don't have them. I bring them with me. I travel, basically, a lot. And so I always have a book. But to be honest with you, I mean, the last couple of books, you would laugh at me. I mean, one is about taste. One is about a season in Provence. It's about Julia Child. I mean, you know, so the books that I'm reading are connected to my subject matter, and they're purely nonfiction. But the input that I get from information online is like volumes. I mean, I'm reading more now than if I were getting magazines at home. Remember magazines? They came in like the mail, they wrote paper and stuff like that. Well, I'm getting just a boatload of stuff online, so I'm able to kind of digest a lot more information than I ever was before, you know.
Do you have any one like single favorite cookbook?
You know, aside from my own.
Aside from your own, which is amazing.
Do I have a single favorite cookbook?
Or one that you've ever, like, you know, been most inspiring to you, you know what I mean?
I hate to disappoint you on this one. I have a collection of cookbooks. I mean, I don't know. I think that there's some classics. I mean, Jacques Pepin wrote like a cookbook on technique, but no, I don't think that I really do. I keep collecting them, and if I find one or two things in each one that I can absorb, whether it's a technique or an ingredient or a recipe, I'm happy. I will say this, I got lucky even in cooking school, right? Because I take a professional class in cooking school. I had to go at night after work. Ran out of the office and ran to school. And the guy that I'm, who's the teacher, is a guy by the name of James Peterson. Mm-hmm. I don't know him from a hole in the wall, but he seems like a pretty good teacher. He owned a restaurant. He like really knew him. He was really big on kind of like the sauce preparation, like really big on that. And then, you know, I graduated. I had to do an internship at the Food Network for a couple of like 4 months, which was great fun for me. And then like a year or two later, a book comes out. It's called Sauces, SAUCES. And it's written by James Peterson. And it has become essentially kind of like the Bible in the food world. It's probably the foremost book of or maybe one of two, of the foremost guides to making sauces in the world, in the world of cooking.
Awesome.
So if I had to go, you know, for me, And again, it's heady. This is not like a book like mine. This is not like a book for the everyday guy. This is like, you really want to master the subject, you read sources. But that for me was kind of great.
Well, I mean, that's French.
And I like, right? I like a lot of Jacques Pepin's books because they're very much technique oriented.
Okay.
And it's just that people aren't going to take the time, Brandon, to study a lot of technique. What I tried to do in the writing of my own book was I would say, look, I went to cooking school so that you don't have to. I'm going to tell you what it is that you need to know.
Right.
I can improve your knife skills that you can kind of practice on your own. But I did lay out like the 10 principles of cooking, you know, what's the difference between, you know, baking and roasting and sauteing and braising. And so I laid out kind of like how to cook. Mm-hmm. And then I threw in 100 recipes, of which I would say 95 of them use maybe 5 ingredients or so. You know what I mean? So that's what I put together.
That's great for that's great for a stay-at-home dad, you know, any dad cooking, and the wives. My wife is recently just, her cooking skills, again, have just continued to improve. You start with a base somewhere and you continue to work on it. What would you say is your signature dish? What's your signature dish?
You know, there's three, I would say. I think that even though it's not exciting, if I can roast a good chicken, that matters the most to me. And I'll tell you why. When you go to cooking school, one of the things you learn is that if a restaurant is going to hire a chef, they test them generally on two things. They test them on the quality of their roast chicken, mm-hmm. and on the quality of their omelet, right? So the stuff that seems very simple, right? But but there's a difference between simple and executed with perfection. So I'm big on getting a perfect roast chicken, right? Which is like loaded with flavor, juicy, and yet at the same time, crisp skin. I mean, like, that's good. I would say if I had two kind of dishes that I'm known for, one is going to be brisket. I braise brisket in beer, mm-hmm. and use like a half a dozen onions and some cayenne pepper, and that's just beautiful eating right there.
Okay.
And easy because it's in one pot. And the other one I think that I'm kind of known for, as I mentioned before, is the ancho chili shrimp. I do the ancho chili shrimp, Brandon, with shrimp, which you get by the ton in North Carolina, and you don't have to pay a lot. Like I could get, you know, good shrimp that's fresh for $10 a pound. And I hit them up with some salt, and I blast them with a hit of the ancho chili pepper. And in the saute pan goes some olive oil, butter if you want, it doesn't matter, but olive oil, a little bit of, you don't even have to put anything else in right now. I'm going to heat the olive oil. And all I'm going to do is I'm going to cut up some garlic, right? I'm going to slice some garlic and I'll throw it in with the shrimp and with the ancho. And then I take that mixture, shrimp, salt, sliced up garlic, ancho chili powder, and then put that all in that hot saute pan, right? And then after like 2 minutes, like you turn over the shrimp so you can see they're pink on one side. Now we're going to get it to the other. Don't overcook them because then they get rubbery. And then when that's done, I may finish it off with like a squeeze of lemon or lime. Now, you could eat that shrimp, Brandon, straight out of there and go, okay, fine, it's an appetizer.
Sure.
Or you could cut off the tail, right? And you could put it inside two tortillas with some cheese and some cilantro and maybe some avocado and go, oh, I have ancho shrimp quesadillas. We love those. Or you could take that shrimp, my brother does, is he takes the spaghetti, right? And he takes and he makes a lot of extra gravy, if you will, by squeezing lime juice, more olive oil, and some cilantro, and mixes that up with pasta. Mm-hmm. So you have this ancho chili kind of, you know, pasta Mexican profile. So I would say those are kind of my three go-tos: the roast lemon garlic chicken, the braised beef brisket in beer, and the ancho chili shrimp.
There you got it, guys. There you got it. Awesome. What anything that you want to hit on fatherhood wise or cooking wise before we pop off of here?
Well, again, just to bring the whole thing together, there are plenty of things that you can do with your kids, but there's also something else that you can do for them, and it matters whether you cook with them or for them. The preparation of a meal and the sharing of it together at the family table with some regularity is an important thing to do, not only, you know, as a bonding thing, not only as a nutritional thing, but in terms of kids' development, that time spent together really does, matter as much as so many other things does. And, not to, to self-promote, that's why I kind of wrote a book to encourage and make easy and fun and creative work for guys. It doesn't mean that women shouldn't be cooking. It doesn't mean that mom can't cook. It means that, you know, the more that women are busy doing other things, the more opportunity we have to bring something to the dinner table, as it were.
Well worded, Rob. Well worded. You navigated that very nicely. You're on a mission to get more men to cook too, right? So I love that. I love that. That's kind of like part of it is a mission for you, and I think that that shines through.
Thank you.
Yeah. So again, where can we send people to go find Rob, Short Order Dad Rosenthal?
Well, this is easy, Brandon. I made it easy as a former branding guy. Short Order Dad shows up pretty much anywhere you look, meaning that Short Order Dad can be found on Twitter. Short Order Dad can be found on Instagram. ShortOrderDad.com can be found as a website. Short Order Dad can be found on a Facebook page. And what I'm going to offer up about the website is that there's a tab on the website. It says Ask Rob, right? So it's an opportunity for people to go, hey, what kind of pasta should I make tonight? I have, you know, these fresh ingredients. And I've actually did it in such a way that you could ask the question in a text, or you could ask it on a video, and then if I get it on a video, I'll respond on a video. So that's available on shortordad.com. And of course, the book is available pretty much anywhere you can buy a book online, whether it's Walmart or Barnes & Noble, obviously Amazon. And I think it's like, I don't know, 10, 12 bucks these days, but I think it's worth it to learn how to, you know, put, you don't need 100 recipes. You need to have 5 go-tos. You know, so that the kids at some point go, hey, Dad, can you make that thing again that I like so much?
Right. That's awesome.
That's a win for everybody.
Absolutely. Rob, thanks again for stopping on today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Brandon. Thanks for having me.